My talk. I'm going to talk about methods, but I'm also going to talk primarily about the application of those methods and talk you through a research question that shows the different kinds of methods that we have used. This is a project, HUSTA, funded by NIOSH, and in the way of advertising, I will say that Tony Marin, our project coordinator, is going to be talking about our Promotora program this afternoon, and Tom Arcuri is going to be talking in more detail about the sampling method that I'm going to mention here. I'm going to be talking about power relations in the poultry processing plants, and somehow I managed to get two colons in here, which for an anthropologist is really, you know, a good deal. when you did your dissertation, you tried to get a colon in the title. We are working in Western North Carolina, and in contrast to Linnae's study, in which you had very eager participation, or at least collaboration, with growers, we do not have cooperation with the employers of the poultry processing workers. They work in five plants over about a six-county area. There we are. And we don't have the cooperation, and so that's a setting in which this is done. For those of you who don't know, poultry processing is a pretty dangerous industry. The injury rates, the illness rates are very high. A lot of musculoskeletal injuries, a lot of dermatological problems. Nationwide, we think there are about 250,000 poultry processing workers. They are largely minority. They always have been. But now they are primarily immigrants. Probably 40-some percent of them are Latino. Others are Eastern European. Others are Pacific Islanders. There is really a substantial potential for worker exploitation in this industry, and what we're calling organizational, and others have called it, organizational injustice. We're in the rural South. The rural South is and always has been non-union. It's a highly competitive industry. It's a right-to-work state. And so employers are trying to make their dollar with as few workers as possible, cutting as many corners as possible. We have issues of documentation status and language, so workers are not talking to, are not talking to their employers, and employees are not talking, and so there's a real potential here for workers to be exploited. What I want to do in this presentation today is to show you some research that we did to try to identify the structure of power relations in the poultry processing plants. And then what I want to do is to take that data, link it with some self-reported injury data to demonstrate how power relations and organizational injustice probably lead to adverse health outcomes. What did you hit? Okay. You can see here in blue the counties in which we're working in the western part of the state, and we're located, our university is located in Forsyth County, which is yellow. Had I stayed more than 2 seconds on the intro slide, you would have seen that this project is a collaboration between Wake Forest University School of Medicine and the Western North Carolina Workers Center, which is actually located out here in Burke County. You want to hit the next one? You seem to have a way with it. Okay. I'm going to be putting together data that we gathered with two different techniques. Early on in the project, as we were trying to understand the experience of poultry processing workers, we conducted a series of in-depth interviews. These were one-on-one interviews. There were current and former workers, evenly divided between current and former poultry workers, and male and female. And that gave us kind of a range of what the opinions and experiences were. And you can see here some description of that. I will point out that anywhere from a quarter to a third of the workers in different places are from Guatemala. Many of them are Mayan speakers, Mayan language speakers, and the rest are largely Mexican. Subsequently, we conducted survey interview. Tom Arcuri is going to be talking about how we developed a sampling frame to get a representative sample of current workers, 200 workers. And you can see here that in many ways, the two samples are quite similar. So those are the two data sets I'm going to use. But I'm going to start off with the qualitative in-depth interviews and give you the results from that. As we read these interviews, and even as the interviewers came back and started talking about them before they were translated and transcribed, there were power relations all over these interviews. People talked about ethnicity. Americans were always higher than Latinos in the plants. They talked about immigration status. People with good papers had more power than people who were undocumented. And they talked, of course, about job rank. Supervisors always have more power than workers do. And so I'm going to give you some examples of those. That's the basis for the power relations in these plants. And we'll start off talking about ethnicity. And the basic thing with ethnicity is that Latinos get the worst jobs. They get fewer breaks than American workers. Here are a couple of quotations. One woman said, "The Americans are always given the easier jobs and Latinos the harder jobs. If, for example, you worked in packing where they put out the trays you put the chickens on, you would find American women there. You would never see a Latina there. The Latinos are always where there's blood, where everything is the worst." Breaks was a big issue. If you want to go to the bathroom, they won't let us. If an American asks to go to the bathroom, they let them go quickly. So ethnicity was a basis for power relations. But immigration status was a big issue, too, because those without immigration papers are much more likely to be abused by the supervisors. And the big thing is they get threatened with being fired all the time. Undocumented workers don't talk because they're afraid that the supervisor will tell them that if they don't want to work, they need to go home. I know the supervisor does that because he knows that they don't have papers. So it's quite widely known in the plant who has good documents and who has bad documents. Did I hit it? Okay. And the third basis for power relations then is job rank. And again, supervisors threatening firing workers. "They have restricted my movements in the plant," one woman said, because she was speaking out. "The person who talked to me told me this was my last opportunity. He asked me to please not go around calling strikes, to take care of my own job because they could fire me at any time. And now I am careful to keep my job." One of the things that has happened is that Latinos have risen to the level of supervisor. And there we get still the exploitation of workers by those over them. So Latino supervisors are particularly guilty of mistreating other Latinos. One woman said, "There was a man named Pedro. It was a horrible experience working for him. He would get behind us with a clock and give us seconds to do a job." So the three bases for the power relations then were ethnicity, documentation status, and the work rank. But there are two things that really cross-cut this. One is kinship and the other one is gender. There are preferences and privileges that are given to family members. So if you have a Latino who rises to the level of supervisors, this is what happens. There's supervisors who have siblings and cousins working there. They treat them well, but they treat the rest of us badly. This is an injustice. And by badly, it means you get the bad job, you don't get a break, and so forth. Gender is also an issue. If you're a young girl and flirt and smile at the supervisor, he'll give you permission to go to the bathroom or to the doctor, but not doing certain jobs because your hands hurt. So if you're a cute young thing, according to the supervisor, you can get special privileges here. So women are much more likely to get that than are men, young women in particular. So that's the structure then of power relations, these three major categories, and then kinship and gender cross-cutting it. Well, what we were interested in seeing is, do power relations translate into injuries? It would make sense that they do. Latinos seem to have the worst jobs in the plants. They're exposed to chemicals, to the birds, to water, to cold, and so on. If they're not getting breaks, the line speed is very high. They're doing a lot of repetitive motions, and these should have musculoskeletal effects. We also know that there's this fear of reporting injuries and abuses, and that these workers have very limited knowledge of what their rights are. So we wanted to look to see if there was evidence that these injuries were related to the situation in the plant. And so we turned to the survey data that we had collected from the qualitative to the survey. In the survey, we had measured what is called retaliatory supervision. And if you look down at the bottom here, there are three questions that we asked people to respond to. And these were done face-to-face, so people didn't need to read and so forth. One was, my supervisor could give me undesirable job assignments. The second one, my supervisor could make my work difficult for me or could make things unpleasant here. And up here what we have is we have the three questions for males and females. So this FQ1 is the first question answered by women, second one by women, and then over here males. And these colors down here, this one is for strongly disagree, and then the two top ones are for agree and strongly agree. The main gestalt to get from this is that anywhere from around 50 to about 35% of the responses were all positive, saying, yes, this kind of retaliatory supervision is actually going on in the plants. So we had a measure of that. We added the three questions together, and then we looked at it with the reports of injuries that we had gotten on the survey. On the survey, because we couldn't get into the plants and we didn't have sufficient funding really to do physical exams, we used questionnaires that allowed us to get at indicators, symptoms of different kinds of problems. And so you see here what we have were skin problems, back and neck pain, arm and hand, and so forth. So these were specific ones right here. And then down here, this is self-rated health, excellent, good, fair, poor, and so on. Having more than one problem and then having any musculoskeletal problem. And when we looked at the association between retaliatory supervision and these health indicators, we adjusted it for depressive symptoms as an adjustment for mood at the time somebody was answering the questions. And you can see here that for the women in the survey, almost all of these health indicators are significantly related to retaliatory supervision. The only one that isn't is skin injuries. Over here for men, only a couple of them are related. So it appears that there's support for idea that the power relations in the plant that result in this retaliatory supervision are actually linked to health outcomes. We documented, first of all, what the power relations were. We documented that documentation and kinship status were really important in this population. That differentiates it from a lot of other industries that might not have immigrant workers in them. And then made this association with health. What's interesting is if you go into the existing literature on organizational injustice and on retaliatory supervision, people have looked at that with the outcomes being mental health indicators, stress experienced by workers, sick days reported by workers, taking time off from work. But nobody has really looked to see if this kind of abusive supervision results in physical injuries. Our results seem to indicate that it does. There are obviously limitations to this study. Our samples are non-random, though, as you're going to hear this afternoon in Tom's talk, there is a mouse running on the floor right there. That's very interesting. it went that away. Okay, calm yourself. Sorry that won't be captured on the recording here. We had non-random samples, but we did our best, and Tom's going to talk about how you sample in a hidden population like this. It only represents Western North Carolina, and of course we had to rely on self-report data. So our conclusion is that we need additional research to really establish that organizational injustice and worker injuries are related. We need stronger measures of both, particularly the health measures, and we need to look in other populations. But should that be supported, we need to be working toward policies and practices that improve working conditions and provide adequate safeguards for workers. So what I've tried to do in this presentation is to show you how we took two different kinds of methods that people have listed here. We've talked about qualitative methods and in-depth interviews. We've also talked about surveys and tried to show you how we put them together to establish the relationship between the work environment and the health outcomes for workers. Thank you.
That's going backwards. I don't know what's going on.
So this was a very full session with lots of information. We have a little bit of time for questions. So first of all, let's give another round of applause for all the presenters. So if anyone has questions for any of the presenters about this work in general, yeah, right in front.
Okay, the question was, what was the reason for the lack of cooperation with the employers? It's probably multifactorial, not the least of which is that in saying that we want to work with poultry processing workers who have very little voice in the company anyway, to say that we want to find out about occupational injuries is not something that most employers want to encourage. There have been a number of papers that have elsewhere that have talked about the underreporting of injuries, the underreporting by the supervisors in the plants, and so that's an issue. There's also real fear that by talking to workers about their rights, which is what we do as well as injuries, that they will organize. These employers are also at risk because they are employing undocumented workers, and many of them know that, and they are raided then, and their production falls. So lots of reasons.
Next question. Yeah.
The question then is whether there are indigenous farm workers who migrate into Washington or from Washington elsewhere.
No, the folks you're working with, yeah. Know that they move on to Washington State, so that I'm from Washington State, so I would like to talk to you about.
The short answer is yes.
Yeah.
And the long answer is that aside from the predominant languages that we see, there are additional languages that are also seen in Washington and our partners in Washington from legal services up there have reported back to us about the increasing numbers in certain pockets, and we have gone up there to provide additional training in Washington as well. And you have something else to add?
I just wanted to say that we also have worked with the Columbia Legal Services, that we have put together a training for interpreter, people who speak other language besides Spanish.
Yeah. Which the farm workers or?
The Indigenous Project did not have a question embedded about tobacco use. So that's the response to that question. And as to whether or not we
what
will...
about juice, alcohol and drugs?
We didn't ask about alcohol or drugs. In the focus of our work was to find out what they perceived to be occupational health issues. And since I'm up here for just a second, I wanted to flag something. One of the surprising things that they did identify, particularly the women, was sexual abuse and sexual harassment in the field, which then paralleled into a separate project and is sort of an offshoot of what Sarah was talking about. So I just wanted to say that while I'm up here.
We did ask questions about tobacco use and about alcohol use. We were not able to associate that with injury reports simply because we didn't have time-specific data to be able to say, were you drinking when you experienced the injury? And I think that kind of data you would really need to collect on an ongoing basis. But it's certainly, I mean, it's an issue, but we don't know how big an issue it is.
Yeah, in the... Yeah, you.
I had a question for you.
All right, go ahead.
Your stories are so much like what in your finding what the eastern part of North Carolina and my sexual workers. I'm really interested if you've got any insight on workers in the technique that management is using to co-opt workers as they move up in time.
I get your question is do we have any idea of what techniques employers are using to co-opt workers as they move up, as they move into the managerial positions? I don't think we interviewed any of those people specifically, and so I'm really not sure. They obviously are paid more, they have greater job security. Most of them have good papers to be working. They all have good papers to be working in those positions. And I'm not exactly sure that management needs to co-opt them. They came here to work as well. They're going to be good employers in the eyes of management. And I think that then the workers beneath them get the fallout from that. I'm not sure that management really needs to do anything, but that's a good question. It's something we all ought to be investigating.
Other questions? Yeah, Dave.
That's an interesting question, and I probably should have said something about that. I think there are a couple of things going on. One is I think that women certainly are much more susceptible to the pressures. They rank lower than low in most job situations. But also, I think there's an increasing literature that shows that women are more likely in situations like this to get carpal tunnel syndrome and other musculoskeletal injuries because of body size. A lot of these women are very, very small, and their workstations are not proportioned to their bodies. And so they are probably much more at risk because they are women and they are small. Okay.
That's enough.
Dorothy?
Sorry, I can't
lie. I knew you were going to say something. Well, that's what she said.
Women are restricted in which... Yes, there's an overlap in the jobs, but there certainly are jobs hanging. Some women do that job, hanging chickens, but largely that is done by men. Trimming is largely done by women, and that will entail different kinds of injuries. So I think it's a complicated interaction, but certainly the jobs that men have can cause injuries as well.
Urban areas is something that there's just a greater need for that than
we have time for one more question. Okay, back there.
Remember both questions. The first question was acceptability?
Yes.
And productivity. Yes and yes. One of our work team members was a Native American woman from New Brunswick, Canada, who has been with the project from the onset. And part of the Native Americans, their use of which blueberry rake, a single-handled over and extended, has a little bit to do with tradition. She was using her grandfather's rake. And by the end of the research, she was interested in extended handles. The productivity, we surveyed at the 4 hour, after they've worked for 4 hours, and asked them how many boxes did they rake, extended handle versus single handled, and then extrapolated that into an 8 hour period of time, and that was significant. I just wanted to comment about the binational research. We're actually doing work with, as I was just saying, that same woman. She lives in Canada, so we are doing research in Canada as well.
Okay, I just want to say we're over time, but we'll stay here taking some questions because I think the next one is until 10:30, but I don't want to keep people hostage. So final round of applause for everyone. It's really inspiring work that people are doing, and we probably have time for 5 minutes or so of more questions if people want to ask. Yeah, Lisa.
Just a quick one here about sustainability. I believe this was, all these grants are funded to be capacity building. That's the origin of NIHS and IOSH funding. I can speak from my project. The sustainability of that will be further projects that we are looking for, other sources of funding. But at the community level, the sustainability is guaranteed by the work we did in churches, radio, newspapers. So the sustainability of diffusion and information is there because we don't depend on the government money to do that. What we depended on the government money to do is to continue the research side. That I believe there's no guarantee of sustainability unless we find long-term funding. And these projects are 4 years. It's good enough to get started, but they don't guarantee sustainability of the research side.